Okay, so are you ready for this? We are diving deep into Mark's gospel today.
Sounds good.
Chapters 8.14 through 9.1.
Oh, wow.
Buckle up.
Okay.
It's going to be a wild ride. This passage is full of surprises.
Yeah.
Even if you think you know it, you're going to be surprised by how much is packed into this.
It's a very rich section.
So to help us unpack all of it, we're going to be looking at this amazing lecture by Dr. Mark Jennings. He just brings up such good points.
Right.
So just to give you a little taste of what we're going to be talking about, we are going to be exploring why Jesus compares his disciples to the Pharisees who want to kill him.
Oh, wow.
We've got a miracle in here that seems to happen in stages. Mm-hmm. And we're going to try to really figure out what it really means to follow Jesus according to Mark.
That's a great question.
So the passage starts out with this scene that's almost funny, you know?
Yeah.
In a relatable kind of way. Jesus and his disciples are in a boat, and the disciples realize they only brought one loaf of bread again. They're totally freaking out about running out of food. And Jesus warns them about the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod.
Right.
Yeast. I mean, what's that all about?
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange image.
Yeah. It seems kind of random.
It is, but if you think about it, even just a tiny bit of yeast can affect a whole loaf of bread. It spreads and changes the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
So Jesus is using this kind of everyday image to show how the influence of the Pharisees and Herod, like a spiritual contamination, it can spread and corrupt.
So it's not just about literal bread.
Right, exactly.
He's using this metaphor to point to something much deeper.
It's about their ideas, their way of thinking, and how those can sort of seep into everything if you're not careful.
So he's really highlighting how the Pharisees and Herod, they represent this opposition to Jesus and his message, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But what I find really fascinating is how Jesus connects this idea of yeast to the disciples' own lack of understanding. It's like he's saying, you guys, you've seen me perform all these miracles. You've witnessed my power firsthand, and yet you're still worried about running out of bread.
That's so true.
It's almost as if he's saying their lack of faith is a kind of blindness.
Mm.
Similar to the blindness of those who oppose him.
That's a good point.
You know?
Yeah, that's a really insightful connection. Jesus is drawing this parallel between the disciples' spiritual blindness, you could say, and the opposition he faces from the Pharisees and Herod. And this is where Mark, I think, gets really clever, because right after this, he follows it with a story about a blind man. But this healing, it's anything but straightforward.
Yeah, this miracle, it always throws me off. So Jesus, he puts spit on the man's eyes, touches him, and asks, do you see anything? And the man says, I see people, but they look like trees walking around. I mean, what does that even mean?
Right.
It's like he can kind of see, but not really.
Yeah.
It's such a strange detail.
It is strange. And that's exactly why Mark includes it. So up until this point in Mark, Jesus's healings, they've been instant and complete. But this one, it happens in these stages. So first, there's like blurred vision, and then he gets full sight.
So I've always kind of felt like those traditional interpretations, you know, where they say that the two stages represent like, you know, the gradual process of spiritual growth. I don't know. They've always felt a little bit unsatisfying to me.
Right.
Like there's something more to it, you know.
I think you're on to something there. If you think about it, the blind man's initial partial sight, like that in-between state, it's actually kind of mirrored in the disciples' own struggle to truly see who Jesus is.
Oh, okay.
They've witnessed these incredible miracles. They've heard his profound teachings, but they still don't fully grasp his identity or really like the full implications of his mission.
So is Mark suggesting that the disciples are kind of like the blind man? They're stuck in this in-between state, seeing things partially, but not yet with complete clarity.
Precisely. And just like the blind man eventually receives full sight, Mark is subtly kind of hinting, I think, that the disciples, too, eventually they'll come to see Jesus clearly. But it's going to be a process.
Yeah.
It's going to be a journey of faith that involves wrestling with difficult truths, challenging their own preconceived notions.
That's a really interesting way to connect that miracle to the disciples' journey.
Yeah.
But, you know, their struggle to understand who Jesus is, I think, is never more apparent than in the scene where Peter makes his famous confession.
Right.
Jesus just asks them point blank, who do you say that I am?
It's a huge question.
And Peter, to his credit, answers correctly. He says, you are the Messiah.
Yeah.
But then it all goes downhill from there.
Yes, it does. And this is where I think understanding the historical context is so important. So in first century Judaism, there were all these different expectations about what the Messiah would be like. Some people thought he would be a powerful warrior king, like overthrow Roman rule. Others thought he'd be more of a priestly figure. Peter, it seems, he kind of shared that very human, very limited view of what Messiah meant.
Which is why he totally freaks out when Jesus starts talking about suffering and death.
Yeah.
It totally contradicts his understanding of what a triumphant Messiah should be like.
Exactly.
Huh.
And Jesus's response to Peter's rebuke, it's shocking. He says, "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns."
Wow. Those are really strong words.
Yeah.
It's like Jesus is saying that Peter, in trying to protect him from suffering, is actually working against God's plan.
It's like he's saying, "You're actually tempting me away from what I'm supposed to do."
And what's really striking to me is that Jesus uses almost the exact same language to rebuke Peter that he used earlier when talking about the yeast of the Pharisees and Herod. Yeah. It's like he's putting Peter in the same category as those who are actively opposing him.
That's a powerful parallel that Mark is drawing there. He's highlighting the danger of human perspectives, even those that are well-intentioned, but ultimately don't align with God's will.
And this really sets the stage for Jesus's radical teaching on what it really means to be his disciple.
It does. He's going to really turn their understanding of discipleship upside down. You see, Jesus isn't interested in conforming to human expectations.
Right.
Even those of his closest followers.
Yeah.
He's about to turn their understanding of discipleship completely upside down.
And he doesn't hold back at all. He turns to the crowds and the disciples and says, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me."
It's a huge statement.
That's a statement that needs some serious unpacking. What does it even mean to take up your cross in this context?
Yeah, that's where understanding the historical context is just so crucial.
Yeah.
We can't just gloss over that imagery.
Yeah.
In the Roman world, the cross wasn't some abstract religious symbol.
Right.
This was a brutal instrument of execution,
yeah.
A public spectacle,
yeah.
Reserved for the lowest of criminals and those who dared to challenge Roman authority.
So when Jesus tells his followers to take up their cross, he's not talking about enduring some minor inconvenience or putting up with daily annoyances. He's calling them to a radical way of life.
Oh, wait.
That embraces self-denial, suffering, and even the possibility of death.
Absolutely.
It's a complete rejection of those values that dominated Roman culture.
It is.
Like power and status and self-preservation.
Yeah. And this is where we see that stark contrast with those popular ideas about the Messiah that we were talking about.
Right.
Jesus is redefining what it means to be the Messiah. He's not a conquering king.
Right.
He's not going to overthrow Roman rule by force. He's a suffering servant who willingly embraces the path of humility and sacrifice and ultimately death on a Roman cross.
It's mind-blowing when you really think about it. And then he goes even further. He compares those who are ashamed of him and his words to those who rejected God's provision and guidance in the wilderness.
Wow.
He says, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it." This whole idea of losing your life to save it, it's a paradox, isn't it?
It is.
It's not something that our human logic really easily grasps.
Yeah, it's a paradox and it's a profound one. But it gets to the heart of what it means to be a disciple of Jesus. It's about surrendering our selfish desires, our need for control, our fear of loss, and placing our trust completely in him. It's about aligning our lives with his will, mm-hmm. even when it seems counterintuitive or even dangerous.
That's so challenging, but also so liberating in a way.
Right.
It's like saying, I'm letting go of my own limited understanding of how things should be.
Yeah.
And trusting in this much bigger picture, a divine plan that I can't fully comprehend.
Absolutely. And it's in that surrender, that act of radical trust, that we find true life, true freedom, and true fulfillment.
Yeah.
But Mark doesn't stop there. He throws in this cryptic statement from Jesus that has puzzled interpreters for centuries. He says, "Truly I tell you, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come with power." Okay, now I'm really confused.
Yeah.
What in the world is Jesus talking about? Is he talking about the second coming?
That's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
Some scholars believe Jesus is referring to the transfiguration, which happens a few chapters later in Mark. But I've always thought those interpretations that just focus solely on the transfiguration, they feel a little limiting.
Right.
It's like they miss this bigger point that Mark is making throughout this whole section.
You're exactly right. This whole passage is saturated with the theme of suffering, of a Messiah who defies human expectations and embraces the path of the cross. So how does this statement about the kingdom coming in power fit into that context?
Well, I think we need to understand that the coming of the kingdom isn't just a future event.
Oh, okay.
It's something that is already breaking into the present through Jesus's ministry.
Okay.
His miracles, his teachings, his confrontations with the religious authorities, all of these are signs of the kingdom's power at work.
So you're saying that the kingdom's power is not just about some far-off event.
Right.
It's also about the transformation that happens when we align ourselves with Jesus, even if that means embracing suffering.
That's exactly it. And I think the ultimate manifestation of the kingdom's power, the event that truly seals the deal, is the resurrection. Think about it. The resurrection is the ultimate victory over death. It's the ultimate demonstration of God's power. It's the moment when Jesus' true identity as the Messiah, the Son of God, is fully revealed. And it's an event that some of his disciples will witness firsthand. So this cryptic saying about the kingdom coming in power is actually kind of a subtle foreshadowing of the resurrection.
I think so.
Mark is dropping these little hints about the ultimate climax of the story, even while he's still building the tension around Jesus' suffering and death.
Exactly. And by weaving these seemingly paradoxical elements together, Mark is inviting us to wrestle with the tension between suffering and glory, between the cost of discipleship and the promise of resurrection.
It's brilliant storytelling.
It is.
But it also raises a lot of questions for us, you know, as readers, as people trying to follow Jesus today. What does it look like to embrace this radical understanding of discipleship in our own lives? How do we reconcile the call to self-denial and suffering with our natural desire for happiness and fulfillment?
That's the challenge, isn't it? And I don't think there are any easy answers, but perhaps the key is to realize that true joy and fulfillment aren't found in avoiding suffering, but in embracing the path that Jesus lays out for us, a path that leads through the cross to the empty tomb.
It's like that two-stage healing we were talking about, right? Yeah. We might not see clearly at first. You know, maybe we're stumbling around like that blind man seeing Kreese walking around.
Right.
But as we trust Jesus and walk with him through the tough times, our vision starts to clear up, right? We start to see the power of his kingdom, even in the midst of the suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. And that really challenges our typical ideas about what it means to be blessed or successful. We're so conditioned to think that happiness is about getting more stuff or achieving a certain status or avoiding pain at all costs. But Jesus, he just totally flips that script.
He's saying true blessing, it's found in humility, in serving other people, in letting go of our selfish desires. And ultimately, it's about discovering our true identity and purpose in him.
Yeah.
Even when it means sacrificing everything the world tells us is important.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? Are we willing to let go of our own agendas and embrace that radical way of Jesus? Are we willing to follow him even when it leads us down a path that the world might consider foolish or even dangerous?
It's a question I think we all have to wrestle with. You know, there's no easy answer. But what we've seen in this deep dive into Mark's gospel is that discipleship, truly following Jesus, it isn't for the faint of heart. It takes courage. It takes commitment. And it takes a willingness to see the world through the lens of faith, not just through our own limited human perspective.
That's so true. And the amazing thing is that Jesus doesn't just call us to this radical way of life. He gives us the power to actually live it.
Yeah.
He promises to be with us every step of the way,
yeah.
Even when things get really tough and we're not sure what to do next.
And that's what gives us hope. Even when the road ahead seems really daunting, knowing that Jesus is walking with us, that he's already overcome the world, that empowers us to face whatever challenges come our way.
The insights from Dr. Jennings' lecture have really illuminated this passage in Mark for me. What stands out to you from this deep dive?
You know, what I find so striking is how Mark, he connects all these seemingly random elements, like the disciples forgetting to bring the bread, the blind man getting his sight in the stages. Like, all these things come together to reveal this deeper truth about discipleship. It's not a straight line, is it? It's this process. It's a journey of faith that involves struggle and growth and these moments of profound clarity along the way.
Yeah. And those moments of clarity, they often come when we least expect them, you know, mm-hmm. Sometimes through suffering, sometimes through challenges that force us to confront our own limitations and depend more fully on Jesus.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into Mark 8.14, test 9.1, I'm left with this question. How does this understanding of what it truly means to follow Jesus challenge your own assumptions about faith, about success, about the meaning of life? It's something I'm still thinking about, and I encourage you to do the same. Maybe this deep dive is just the beginning of your own exploration.